Of Boston. Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Soccer fans, this is it, your weekend. Brazil and the Netherlands face off for third place at the World Cup on Saturday, and Germany will play Argentina in the final on Sunday. Millions of fans around the world are expected to tune in for the final matches. We wanted to help you get ready, but we also wanted to touch on some of the important stories that have been going on off the field, or rather the pitch, as they say in soccer as well. Joining us once again from Rio de Janeiro is Ricardo Zuniga. He's Latin America sports editor for the Associated Press. Ricardo, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Greg Howard. He's editor of Deadspin soccer website Screamer and a writer for Deadspin. Greg, welcome to you as well. Thanks for coming.
Hey, Michelle. How you doing?
I'm good. So, Ricardo, let me start with you, because Brazil was really in mourning after that 7-1 defeat by Germany earlier this week. What's the mood like in Brazil now? Are people still interested?
I think they've lost a lot of interest in the tournament. Obviously, their main goal was to reach the final, and not only reach the final, but to win it all. And after such a demoralizing loss against Germany, it really dampened the mood over here. No one is really interested either in playing or watching this third-place game. And the fact that Argentina, Brazil's main football or soccer rival, is in the final, it's even worse for them. It's like rubbing salt on the wound. So they will be watching Sunday's final, but the interest will be for them to for Germany to win, even though Germany beat them so badly. They would rather see Germany win than Argentina.
Well, you know, the team faced two enormous hurdles at the later rounds. I mean, Neymar badly hurt in the quarterfinals against Colombia, took him out of the tournament. And then the captain, Thiago Silva, suspension. Will Silva be back for the final? Does Brazil have a chance to take third, even though, as you said, kind of the wind is out of the sails at this point?
Yeah, Silva is back. He had just a one-game suspension because of accumulation of yellow cards. And right now it's up for grabs. That third place match, Netherlands coach Luis Van Gaal already said after losing to Argentina in the semifinals that they didn't want to play that match. I think Brazil has at least some motivation to win it, so they don't leave the tournament with such a sour taste in their mouths, and they at least leave a good last impression with their fans. So I think Brazil obviously has some advantage there. They also have an extra day of rest. And you got to remember that the Netherlands played their semifinals on Wednesday. Brazil played theirs on Tuesday. And the Netherlands also played 30 extra minutes. So Brazil has several advantages over the Netherlands for that match.
Greg, what's been the big story of the tournament for you?
Besides Luis Suarez, I think the Brazil match against Germany and them getting thrown the way that they did is probably going to be the thing that people talk about for years, actually. I mean, it's one of the most shocking things I think anyone has ever seen in the sport.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Luis Suarez. We're talking about that this is the Uruguay player who was thrown out of the games for biting another player. This is not the first time that he's done this. But, you know, the uglier side of the game has been on display in this tournament. I mean, the fact that Neymar was hurt so badly because he was kneed in the back and he reportedly couldn't feel his legs after the injury. And then, of course, there are the concussions, which you also wrote about. Do you think that this might be an inflection moment where this side of the sport gets more attention?
It's hard to tell, especially with concussions. I mean, I think it's a big story here because of American football. But I don't know. I mean, Ricardo probably knows better than I do if they're talking about concussions in Brazil, in Uruguay, where Alvaro Pereira, you know, he was hit in the head in back-to-back games really hard. One time he was knocked out and had to, he actually yelled down the team doctor and was put back in the game. I don't know how it is in the rest of the world, but in America, I think that's one thing that people are talking about a lot, and that's probably due to the fact that we are more aware of the danger of concussion due to American football.
Ricardo, what do you think? What do you think? I mean, as we mentioned, these kinds of incidents have happened all along. But they, as we mentioned, this in this country, in the U.S., this has been the most watched tournament, you know, ever. It's been in huge numbers. Do you think that this kind of worldwide focus on this kind of injury will perhaps be a game changer in some way?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I agree with Greg in the fact that with the concussion story, it has been more talked about in the States than over here in Latin America. The football culture in Latin America is very much a macho culture. So for a player to go out of a game because he got, you know, he got knocked down and he lost consciousness for a second, they would never do that. So in a way, it's fairly similar to the what we call American football, quote unquote, NFL culture in the States, where you know players usually wouldn't come out of a game because they got knocked down. But now they have a concussion protocol over there, which FIFA is supposed to have, but they sometimes just don't apply it. Over here, like you mentioned, the Álvaro Pereira's case with Uruguay, for the Uruguay people and the Uruguay media, they couldn't believe that it was such a big issue that people were talking about why did they allow Pereira to go back, when for us, looking at that from the outside, it was probably obvious that he needed to come out of the game. I'm not really sure this is going to change. There will have to be a culture change, not only the rules. The team doctors, they have a vested interest in the player going back. They don't respond to an independent body that oversees the well-being of the players. They respond to the coach. And the coach needs the player to go back to the field, and the player wants to go back to the field. So, like you saw with Pereira in the Uruguay match, or like you saw with Mascherano in the Netherlands match, Mascherano was also shaken after taking a head-to-head hit, and he went back on the pitch, and actually he played probably his best match of the tournament after that. He saved Argentina's... from losing at the very last second when he deflected a Roman shot on goal. So, you know, I don't think it's going to change much, even though it has gotten a lot of attention.
So let's, Ricardo, a couple minutes left. I wanted to get your take on how Brazil has done as host country. As we mentioned, the total bill will reportedly be around $11 billion. And as one analyst said, that's $1 billion for every goal Brazil scored so far. Before the tournament began, you know, people were there was a lot of discussion around whether this was an appropriate use of state dollars, whether this was really worth all the money. What do you think is the sense of it now? What do you think the conversations are going to be after all the visitors leave?
Yeah, I think the conversation will be that some of the stadiums that were built were unnecessary, and the money spent on them could have been spent on better things for the common people, especially the four stadiums that are going to probably become white elephants, and they cost the total cost for those four was $1.6 billion. Those are the ones in Brasilia, Natal, Manaus, and Cuiabá. Those four cities, they don't have major professional teams, so they are already looking at what uses they can give to the stadiums. But these are facilities that cost upwards of $300 or $400 million, and they're probably going to become white elephants. So in the coming years, as we see all these facilities not being used, I think there's going to be some outrage over here on the money spent on the World Cup.
So, Greg, let's turn to the final game, Argentina versus Brazil. Germany, of course, coming off of just its pummeling of Brazil. Argentina versus Germany. So what's your take on the final match? Who has the advantage?
Mm-hmm. I think Germany do. I think they've been the best team in the world for probably the last year. And even though, you know, the tournament's been, you know, a drag for a lot of teams, especially... You know, you hear people saying that no great team has put in a great performance. But, you know, Germany are the better team. And they are, they're coming in off destroying Brazil. I can't look past them over Argentina. Argentina, they have barely conceded this tournament. I think it'll be tight for that reason. But I really can't imagine any other scenario than... Germany dominating the game And, you know, they might win 1-0 or 2-1. I think it'll be close, but I think Germany will they'll dominate the, you know, most of the play, and I think they're going to, you know, hoist the trophy at the end.
Ricardo, what about you?
Well, if I had to pick with my brain, I would pick Germany like Greg does. I'm going to go with my heart, and I think the fact that Argentina has the best player in the world and who is looking to become probably the best player ever, and he just needs to win a World Cup, that's Messi. So I'm going to assess Messi swings the balance towards Argentina 1-0.
He does. Messi, you say him alone. So I guess that he better get wrapped in bubble wrap, right, before the for the weekend and make sure that he's taken care of. Okay, nobody touch him. Nobody with a cold go anywhere near him, right? All right. Ricardo Zuniga is AP's Latin America sports editor. He joined us on the line from Rio de Janeiro. Greg Howard is the editor of Screamer, that's Deadspin's soccer site. He was with us from New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, and if your team came up short at World Cup, take special note. It's so easy to hold on to grudges, but famed pastor T.D. Jakes says there's power in letting go of them.
Forgiveness does not exonerate the perpetrator. Forgiveness liberates the victim.
Bishop T.D. Jakes shares what he's learned about forgiveness. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Americans are smarting after our exit from the World Cup, so we're traveling to Denver just to talk to a young woman who managed to beat the world at something. Olympic gold medalist skier Michaela Schifrin joins us this week from Red Rocks in Colorado. Booyah! I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for a jingoistic Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sunday at noon on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality in our lives. Today we bring you an encore of a Wisdom Watch conversation we had with one of the most prominent religious leaders in America. Bishop T.D. Jakes leads a congregation of some 30,000 people at the Potter's House Church in Dallas, but his influence reaches far beyond his church. He's a prominent public speaker, a film producer, and also the author of many best-selling books. We spoke with him about his book, Let It Go, Forgive So You Can Be Forgiven. This was right before Easter in April 2012, when much of the nation was still gripped by sadness and anger over Trayvon Martin, who'd been killed weeks before by George Zimmerman. Bishop Jakes and I spoke at length about Trayvon Martin's death, but I began by asking him about the moment he felt called to the ministry.
I recognized my calling at about 17 years old. I didn't start ministering till I was 19. And I felt like I had found the thing that I was created to do. That's a real blessing, regardless to what that thing is, to find your purpose and be so committed to it that 35 years later you're still finding fulfillment in it is a great gift.
Did you ever envision at that time that you would be leading such a large ministry, leading such a large church, and in fact a media empire, if you don't mind my calling it that?
Never would have thought it in a million years, and I think if I had, it would have scared me to death. I'm thankful that my life moved along in steps and stages, and I started very small, very meager. My first church had 7 members in it, and I still remember the rent was $225 a month, and I worked for Union Carbide and took the check I made from work to pay for the rent to keep the church open. Those kind of meager beginnings were good for me. It might not be good for everybody, but it was certainly good for me.
What do you think is central to your gift, if you don't mind my asking you that? Obviously, it's an awkward thing for me to ask you, but what do you think it is?
It's kind of awkward for me to answer because I think what causes anybody to be effective at what they do is this nebulous, indescript thing that I call the it factor. But if I were to make a stab at it, I think I have never lost connectivity and relativity to the people with whom I seek to serve.
You know, to that end, you do talk a lot about your own experiences in your latest book. You've written quite a few. The latest is Let It Go, Forgive, So You May Be Forgiven. Why this book and why now?
There are several things that led to it. One is I am very disturbed by the times in which we live. The death of civility in our generation is very disturbing. The conflicts in Washington, I know that they've always been, but they have reached a level whereby we have lost all sensibility and reason. The deterioration of families and marriages and community, there's so much hostility. I think that we need somebody to talk to us about forgiveness before we destroy everything that's important in the process of proving a point.
You mean that on a personal level, on an interpersonal level? A lot of the examples you give in the book are sort of interpersonal conflicts that many people have. Is that mainly what you mean, or do you mean more broadly?
I think it's everywhere. I think I describe the unforgiveness as a cancer, and the reason I describe it as a cancer because cancer never stays where you find it. It spreads, and it left unattended will spread throughout the body. And I think that it is a systemic pandemic problem in our personal lives, in our public lives, our professional lives. We have lost reason. And so when I applied much of my book to the day-to-day person who finds themselves wounded emotionally by someone that you've invested in and failed to see a return, and now you find yourself unable to move forward in your life because of what they did or did not do, and yet you're victimized twice if you don't forgive that because it continues to perpetuate itself. And I really wanted to write Let It Go to build a bridge so people could see how to go forward with their life when they're standing at an embankment and see themselves at an impasse emotionally, spiritually, or attitudinally.
How would you recommend someone start? What's the first step that someone should take?
I think the first step is to understand that forgiveness does not exonerate the perpetrator. Forgiveness liberates the victim. It's a gift you give yourself. It has less to do with what somebody else did as much as it does with your decision to move on with your life and not be continually victimized by rehearsing that issue or incident over and over again. And once you begin to understand that forgiveness is not a white flag of defeat, and you begin to understand that it is something to aspire to, I think that's the first step. And then to understand that most of us are grieved because our emotions have not moved forward. And the thing that disturbs me about that is the notion that you allow your emotions to drive the car and your intellect becomes the passenger. When you make a decision to forgive, it's a decision that you have to make intellectually. It's not an emotional decision. And you make your emotions have to ride in the direction of your intellect rather than the other way around.
I'm speaking with the legendary Bishop T.D. Jakes. He is the founder and senior pastor of the Potter's House of Dallas. He is the author of many, many books. His latest is Let It Go, Forgive, So You May Be Forgiven. You know, to that end, you talked about the fact that we are in a troubled time in this country on many levels. One of the things that many people are very troubled about right now is the whole situation around Trayvon Martin, the young man a 17-year-old, unarmed, walking to a friend's house where he had been staying with a can of iced tea and some Skittles, and was shot by a self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer. You've made some strong statements about this, and you said that you don't think this is an isolated case, and that we have to bring a righteous, legal, and satisfactory moral conclusion to this atrocious miscarriage of justice in violation of all reasonable consciousness. This is from a piece you wrote in Huffington Post. But how would you, as a nationally known pastor, encourage people to move on with this case or to address this case right now in the absence of any resolution by the criminal justice system?
I think that the public has done what it needed to do from the perspective of drawing enough attention to it without the efforts of grassroots tweets and Facebook postings and what have you. I'm not sure that Trayvon's case wouldn't have been swept up under the rug and been ignored. And I do think that he is a symptom of a much bigger problem in our society that relates to our whole judicial system, some antiquated laws, some good old boy systems that we have been subjected to atrocities that are unfair and unjust. And now, with the scrutiny that has been drawn to this, I think that the judicial system is grappling with how do we resolve the complexities of this issue. And I think that what we need to do is continue to apply pressure, not only for the benefit of Trayvon, and my heart goes out to his family, as well as Zimmerman's family, quite frankly, because if you are the parent of either child, you bleed today. But even beyond all of that, I think that we have to stand back and let due process work and see where it's going to take us. And what we are after is truth. And we do not want the death of this young man, who appears to be innocent, to go without research. And I'm really proud of the fact that both clergy and rappers and hip-hop artists and news reporters and everybody jumped on the bandwagon to say, no, something has to be done about this. And I have not seen our community galvanize around an issue like this in quite some time. And I do think it is bigger than race. I think that there are certain things about race we certainly need to talk about. But I find many, many people of all colors concerned about the whole judicial system, because if it's my child today, it could be your child tomorrow.
But to the question of race, there are some in the, and, it's hard to find quite the right frame for this, but I'll just say, for the sake of shorthand, the conservative media who have insisted on the point that this is not about race, and their argument is that the fact that many African Americans believe race is a factor is an endemic of an inability to let go and forgive the past racism of this country. And this is where I'd like to ask you to comment on this as a person who's given deep thought to this question.
Michelle, that's just like husbands who have committed infidelity telling the wife to get over it. So this is one of the areas where you don't get to be the teacher. I think that the people who are experiencing discrimination should, at least in this one area, be able to say when they are discriminated against. This has to be a community effort, and there are many people, both black and white, who are concerned about how this is being handled, and for certain news media outlets to play into their particular demographic, while it may drive up the ratings, it's not ratings we're after here, it's justice. And I can almost hear somebody saying, you're a minister and you're out here with a book about forgiveness, and yet you're wanting full disclosure. If you take the time to read the book, you will find that no forgiveness can be complete where there is no truth. And I don't think that there is a conflict of ideas to say that you want justice and still talk about forgiveness. And right now, I think America on both sides of this issue are confused. Nobody knows for sure exactly what happened. We can raise all the questions we want to on both sides, but until we have DNA and evidence and witnesses and all the things that make our judicial system what it is, we can't begin to heal of this process. So I just wanted to bring that final note to the family of Trayvon, that my prayers are with them, because they haven't had an opportunity to grieve. I pray that the time will come that they can normalize into the grief process and begin the healing process. But right now, they just need to have answers. And any mama, any daddy would want to have answers as to what did happen to my child.
Well, before we let you go, as we mentioned, the for Christians, for those who observe, the notion of forgiveness is central to Easter. And I wondered if you know what message you will be delivering this Sunday as you reflect upon Easter.
Here is the amazing thing about Easter, Resurrection Sunday for Christians, is this, that Christ in the dying moments of on the cross gives us the greatest illustration of forgiveness possible. When the very people who crucified him are within his view while he is bleeding to death on a cross, he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." If he can pray that prayer in the throes and clutches of death, hemorrhaging, bleeding, suffering, and dying, then surely it sets a benchmark for the rest of us as to what we will allow to remain unforgiven in our lives.
Well, you left me speechless. I did have a something to think about. Before we let you go, this is what we call a Wisdom Watch conversation. And of course, all your work is about imparting wisdom. Is there any particular bit of wisdom you'd like to leave us with?
In the spirit of the book, Let It Go, I would leave this morsel of wisdom behind, and it is simple. We are a mass of energy. And I would think that if you spend all of your time energizing what has happened in your past, it begs this question: if you energize your history, what will you have left for your destiny? If you continue to expend all of your fuel on where you've been, you'll have no gas for where you're going. If you really want to move forward, it may be time to let it go.
Bishop T.D. Jakes is the founder and senior pastor at Potter's House of Dallas. We spoke with him about his book, Let It Go, Forgive So You Can Be Forgiven. Now, as this program winds down, the last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st, we thought it would be nice to hear about the music members of our staff are listening to as part of our series, In Your Ear. Producer Freddie Boswell has spent most of her life living and traveling outside of the U.S., from Kenya and Tanzania to Bahrain and England, and that definitely informs what's on her playlist.
I'm Freddie Boswell, and as you can hear from my accent, or maybe you can't, I'm Kenyan, British, came here from London, lived in Zanzibar, and that's a lot of what is playing in my ear, songs that take me back to these places. One song is Nipendo, which means it's love in Kiswahili, and it's by a Tanzanian singer called Carola Kinasha. Leo niwe wako, kwangu kuwe kwako, changu kiwe chako. As the title suggests, it is all about love and celebrating love. There are lines like, "Today I'm yours, my home is yours, what's mine is yours." And when I first saw Carola perform this live, it just really struck a chord with me, and I thought it had to be played at my wedding. And I was lucky Carola did, so I just always keep the song with me because it takes me back to my favorite place in the world, a beach in Zanzibar. Another song is Zambezi by a young Brit Zimbabwean singer called Tinashe. Do you remember the day you said I'd be the only one? 'Cause I remember the way you held my gaze, my lovely one. I still remember stealing all the mangoes from the farm just for fun. Just for fun. I love the storytelling in this song, that image of falling in love while stealing mangoes on the farm, and then the soldiers coming.
You remember the day the soldiers came with all their guns? 'Cause I remember.
just tells a beautiful story of love and loss. Another song is the late, great Brenda Fassie's Vulindlela. This year marks 10 years since she died, but this song lives on at every wedding or party I've been to, from DC to London to Kenya. And there's something about the haunting yet fabulous way she opens it with that Vulindlela that I've always loved.
That was Tell Me More producer Freddie Boswell telling us what's playing in her ear. Just ahead, President Obama says he's working on addressing the surge of unauthorized border crossings into the U.S.
I sent a letter to Congress asking them to increase penalties on smugglers and to give us flexibility to move migrants through the system faster.
But he's still getting blasted for not visiting the border. Some are even calling this his Katrina moment. The Barbershop Guys weigh in on that and other news of the week that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. From the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. And from John and Catherine Debs, in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Soul singer Bobby Womack died 2 weeks ago at age 70. On the next Fresh Air, a 1999 interview with him. He was discovered by Sam Cooke, who first recorded him. Womack's hits include the theme from Across 110th Street, Looking for a Love, which was covered by the Jay Giles Band, and It's All Over Now, which was covered by the Rolling Stones and became their first international hit. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
Imagine there's a way to hack into your brain to rewire it, to make you smarter, even happier.
Altering cognitive abilities, altering personality is within our reach now.
It's like science fiction.
It's mapping an unexplored universe.
I'm Guy Raz. The hackers are coming for your brain, the climate, even the animal kingdom, on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturdays at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of themuslimguide.com, is with us from Chicago. Lenny McAllister is a Republican strategist and the host of Get Right with Lenny McAllister on KDKA News Radio, with us from Pittsburgh. And in our Washington, D.C. studios, Corey Dade, contributing editor for the online publication The Root. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas. Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
What up, though?
What's going on now?
Hey, what's happening?
All right. Well, okay. President Obama seems to be in some hot water. with his critics over the U.S.-Mexico border situation that's been boiling over in the past few weeks. Isn't that right, Michelle?
Well, we've been talking about this a lot on the program. As you probably know, the U.S. is struggling to deal with thousands of people, many of them unaccompanied children, and some of them single mothers with children who've been coming across the border. The conditions are not appropriate. They're crowded, certainly not meant for children. Now, the president went on a Southwest swing earlier this week. He went to Colorado. He met with Governor John Hickenlooper there. He went to Texas on Wednesday. He talked with Governor Rick Perry there. But he's been hammered by people, including some Democrats, who say he should have made some time to visit the border himself, especially in a week when he was filmed playing pool and drinking beer during his visit to Colorado. He was meeting with people there. Obviously, he wasn't just, you know, playing pool for himself, but he was talking to constituents. But anyway, this is Congressman Henry Cuellar. He's a Texas Democrat. He's talking about this on MSNBC.
You know, when I saw that, it just really floored me, because if he's saying he's too busy to go down to the border, but you have time to drink a beer, play pool, the optics, I mean, just the appearance means that he's not paying attention to this humanitarian crisis.
Of course he's not, Michelle, and thank you for that piece of tape, because bodies floating down the street is just like people running across the border. Lenny says, some folks are calling this Obama's Katrina moment. Obviously it isn't, but comparing it to President George Bush's, W. Bush's botched response to Katrina, are you one of those folks? I mean, not to put you on the spot or anything, but
to put you on the spot. That's the whole purpose of having me on the barbershop.
But you are now on the spot. Welcome to the barbershop, Mr. McAllister. Go ahead.
This is not Katrina. I don't want people comparing this to Katrina. It's not his Katrina moment. Are the optics bad? Yes. And more importantly, not just was he playing pool, and not just was he having a beer, but he also was in Dallas, North Dallas, raising money, being the epitome of a politician without being the epitome of a leader. That's the issue. Now, we can all agree on that and still say that it's not the same as American citizens stranded and dead in New Orleans after Katrina versus a crisis at the border because he blotched the immigration process when he had control of Congress. Those are two different things completely.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mr. McAllister. Corey Date, I don't understand what he's supposed to do with the border. Is he supposed to stick his hand out like Charlton Heston and do like a Moses and hold him? I mean, what exactly is supposed to happen here? Now, I know you covered the aftermath of the Hurricane Katrina. What do you say to all this, man?
Yeah, I think what he was supposed to do is come down with his staff, and it literally a staff is in the thing you hold, a rod, and part the sea to allow all the children to go back across the other side. I mean, that I think that's what they're expecting. But I mean, realistically, it's totally ridiculous. I mean, Senator John Cornyn from Texas is one of the main ones criticizing him for not coming down. But months ago, in fact, it may have been longer than that, he was one of the main ones who criticized the president for his position on immigration, and also the idea, and just totally rejected the idea that the president come down to the border for a photo op. And now he and every other Republican are the main ones saying, including some Democrats, saying that he should do it. Was a photo op opportunistic? Would it have been? Yeah, but the deal is, it's about how you respond to this crisis materially. Whether he goes down there and is physically seen on the border is absolutely immaterial, because he is already on record. He already has a record of being aggressive in trying to push for immigration reform. So his position on that issue is really not in question here. And the idea of the Katrina comparison is just offensive.
Why is it offensive? I get this.
It's offensive
because that a number of people are offended by this, but tell me why.
Because there are very material distinctions. As someone who was down there on the ground when President H.W. Bush did his flyover, you know, when the response...
It was W. It wasn't H.W. that did that, Corey.
It was W. George W. 43, not 41.
My
but
mistake.
Anyway.
Uh-huh. Right. It was W. You know, I was down there, and also I chronicled sort of the narrative of how the federal response went. And, you know, this is a president who went down there and made a speech and then said, "Brownie, you're doing a good job." He said it directly to the person who was botching the response. And all the while, that entire state was drowning or dying or being stranded. And, you know, this is not what's happening here. We're not talking about a federal government that's not responding to this crisis, because they are. And to Lenny's point about Dallas, yes, he did a photo op in Dallas. He definitely went and raised money. But he also went to the leaders in Dallas who actually did a novel thing. They actually volunteered three facilities to actually house these children, which is the humane approach.
What, Arsene, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that both Lenny and Corey have already sort of hit the nail on the head. This is, certainly is not Katrina. You know, I think that, you know, equivocating, you know, thousands of dead bodies, you know, floating through the streets of New Orleans with this, you know, 50,000 undocumented immigrants is I think it's intellectually dishonest. What I think is interesting, you know, people talk about the optics of President Obama not going there. You know, imagine the optics just from a political vantage point if he does go there and, you know, Republican candidates, you know, have pictures of President Obama with undocumented immigrants. You know, that I can see 30-second ad spots saying, see, look, President Obama supports illegal immigration in the U.S. And so, you know, I think that there's a little bit of intellectual dishonesty going on here. And this might be Republicans, you know, trying to goad him into going only to be used for potential political campaign ads.
Well, it's both sides are trying to goad him. But Lenny, I have to ask you this question, though. I mean, Republicans criticize the president when he takes administrative action. But there's a political disagreement over the direction that immigration reform should take. So I guess what is it that they think should happen other than just agree with them when he doesn't about what should happen legislatively? I mean, I'm just, what is it that he should be doing that he isn't doing? Because when he does take administrative action, they call him a dictator. So
I think the first thing that needs to be understood is the fact that there's having a policy, there's a lack of action that transpired in 2009 and 2010. So to blame Republicans like he's been doing when it comes to immigration over the last several weeks and saying that they're the ones that have stopped immigration reform, when we all know that Univision held President Obama accountable both in 2010 and 2012 for not doing anything in 2009 and 2010. There's something to be said for that. Number two, having a policy position or doing something 500 miles away in Dallas when you're raising money, and that's something not to ignore, Corey, that he raised money, got a couple of groups to have some housing, but that's different than going to the border, especially when this is a new crisis. We had immigration issues previously, but when you start having these busloads of children coming here, some of which where they're been reports where up to one-third of all the girls between the ages of 10 and 15 have been sexually molested or raped on their way up from Central America. When you start talking about that, there's a new need, especially when Julian Castro and the Castro twin brothers have been very close to this administration since the convention in 2012.
What's the relevance of
there's
that?
There's something to say about going to San Antonio and at least meeting with them in southern Texas rather than just staying in Dallas and raising money. So that's where leadership comes into play.
Yeah. Which is why some Hispanic groups leaders have called him the deporter in chief. I mean, they feel that his efforts in law enforcement have been too draconian. So, I mean, clearly, you know
what
I mean?
He's deported a record number of people, unprecedented.
In 2012, he also allowed people to stay here in order to turn the tide with the election. So there are two sides of that coin, and we continuously only want to look at one side or the other. And again, to Arsalan's point, at some point in time, you're going to get it either way from Republicans, so you have to make a choice. Do you want to do things as a politician or things as a leader? He refuses to do things as a leader more often than not because he's afraid of the politics. And as a lame duck president, that is very, very shameful.
Okay. Well, does anybody else have anything to say about this? I think we're going to move on because I think we've had a good elucidation of what the points of view are on this. So if you're just joining us, we're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by Republican strategist Lenny McAllister, that's who was speaking just now, writer Jimmy Israel, journalist Corey Dade, and Professor Arsalan Iftikhar. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, gentlemen, let's move along, talk about sports. As it happens, ESPN's magazine's annual body issue hit the stands today, featuring new athletes to, quote, showcase an array of sports and body types. Okay, they just want to move some magazines. But anyway, this year, they got Michael Phelps and Venus Williams on the cover. Yes, but baseball player Prince Felder is getting a lot of press for his cover shot. Why is that, Michelle?
Well, Felder is, first of all, everybody in this is nude, so it's the body issue. But the buzz is that he's a big guy, that, you know, if he were a woman, we'd say he's curvy. Or as our friend Danny Tucker would say, one of our regular contributors, she'd say he's thick and fit. And here's what he had to say about this for ESPN.
I'm still in my prime, but, you know, I got to be a little more smarter about my fitness as well as my nutrition.
I don't like to eat too bad, but I just like to eat good food. I guess I like to have a 12-pack. That'd be cool.
You know, a lot of people are fine. They're saying, look, this is how it is. I mean, the whole point is that you don't have to be one body type in order to be, you know, fit and to be an athlete. And they think it's all good. And some people say that's driving up that traffic around the hashtag Husky Twitter. So, Jimmy, what do you think about that?
You know what? I think y'all are late because I'm from Cleveland, you know, home of Gerald LaVert, RIP, and you know, men at large. I mean, the men here have been fat and black before it was sexy, and you know I'm no stick. You know, at 225, you know I'm holding it down. But you know we were fat and black before it was sexy. The men here, sisters, y'all know what it's about. But fellas, you're you know, Arslan, what do you think? What do you think?
I think it's great. I think it's absolutely wonderful. You know, in past ESPN body issues, you know, every picture in there has been of Greek gods and Greek goddesses, and you know, with their chiseled, absolutely perfect bodies. And I think that showing, you know, an athlete like Prince Fielder, and you know, keep in mind, he is a good baseball player. You know, he's not just some scrub. He's a good baseball player who doesn't sort of fit that traditional mold of, you know, like the perfect Greek god or goddess body. I think it's absolutely wonderful for those of us who, you know, have similar shaped bodies and are not perfect like everyone that ESPN normally highlights.
Lenny, nah, I've seen you, brother. You could use a pork sandwich. But should Fielder spend more time in magazines or maybe at the gym, bro?
Bottom line is, he's making millions of dollars a year hitting a baseball 400 feet, and he does that well, so why mess with it? Listen, I'd rather, you know, and not that I'm looking at Prince Fielder or anything else, but 20 years ago, it would have been John Kruk. Would you rather Prince Fielder or John Kruk? And 100 years ago, it would have been Babe Ruth. So there's always been these tubby sluggers that have been out there in baseball. Heck, this is a sport where Boston Red Sox players that didn't pitch on certain days just a few years ago got busted drinking beer in the clubhouse. You can't hear about that in the NFL or NHL or anyplace else. So why are we surprised when we're talking about Major League Baseball players, some of them looking like this?
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Corey?
Hey, man, I'm a former football player, so I've never been skinny, never wanted to be skinny. So I like it. I have no problem with it. I think any time we are sitting here talking about the outrageous or controversial nature of a magazine cover, the magazine has succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're moving units.
Well, the fact is, I saw some data that said that, first of all, this issue outsells
absolutely
both in advertising and on the circulation every other issue.
It makes their money for the year. Where they make their money.
But here's my question. How do you feel about that? I mean, how do you feel
Which
about
part?
That? Well, the nudity part. I mean, the fact is a lot of people are saying on the one hand, they say it's a celebration of the body in all its various forms, but some people say this is just another kind of, it's like sex sells. It's like, it's really selling sexuality and then pretending that it's something
it
else. So
well, I think the two aren't mutually exclusive. I think you can sell sex or sexuality and still celebrate the beauty of the human body. Mm-hmm. They almost go together. Well, not they almost. They do go together. And, mm-hmm. you know,
okay, so what would happen if there were a curvy, thick and fit woman on the cover, female athlete on the cover?
It's happened many times.
Really?
Insert Serena Williams.
Serena Williams is not. No, this is, I think, I don't.
She's
I think
not thick?
She's extremely muscular. That's a different. I don't think.
No, she's thick.
She's got a dunk. She's got a dunk. She's 5'11", and she's 150-plus pounds, about 160. Yeah, that's thick. She's
that's
a thick,
thick
girl.
I'm not going to debate thickness.
And she's a great athlete.
She is a great athlete.
Absolutely.
Well, curvier. How about say curvier?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's happening.
You mean like Queen Latifah?
Well, I don't. She's not an athlete, but
you're not. You're going to be hard. You're going to be hard pressed to find world class athletes who are women who are larger, thicker, or curvier, as you put it, than a Serena Williams. Serena Williams is the gold standard for the big, athletic, still sexy woman.
Okay. And you're never going to be able to find that with women because look at the sports that women play at high levels that are high profile. Basketball, volleyball, even if you want to go to Olympic hockey, I mean, they're mm-hmm. constantly moving, so they're not going to look like a baseball player, who, by the way, right. Prince Fielder is a DH, sit on the bench and swing a bat three times a game, first baseman.
Yeah. Really
so, of
good
course,
point.
He's going to look differently than these ladies would.
Yeah, they all those players, first baseman and DH, they're all thick, they're all heavy, and some pitchers. They're the only two positions on baseball who don't really make their money by moving.
Okay. All right. Well, I stand corrected. Okay, how about that? I never thought I'd be having a conversation with male colleagues about thick and fit. But we are.
It's the barbershop, right. You know.
All right. So finally, we just have about a minute and a half left. So listen, we need to find a new way to make money. So let everybody take notes. An Ohio man, not Jimmy, started a Kickstarter campaign to make potato salad. He was looking to raise $10, but the campaign went viral, and at one point he hit the $70,000 mark. And so I'm going to have to – okay, what's your dream Kickstarter campaign? Jimmy, what's yours?
There's a nice signed Baldwin, another country, that first edition I'm trying to get a hold of. So hook up your boy.
Okay. All right, Lenny, what about you?
Probably selling my wife's mystery cheesecake. It's awesome. Mystery it's a mix cheesecake. Of cheesecake and pecan pie. It's fantastic.
Oh, okay, you could have brought us some. Corey, what about you?
Well, it was suggested, shout out to Diva in Philly. She suggested I raise money on Kickstarter to pay everybody's water bill in Detroit. But I'm not really feeling that charitable. So I say I'm trying to raise money for my retirement plan. How about that?
Okay, well, yeah, let's see how that goes. All right, Arsalan, what about you? Hate to bring this up during Ramadan, but what about it?
Yeah, I would start a Kickstarter campaign to make sriracha sauce mandatory in every school lunch in America.
All right. Arsalan Iftikhar is founder of themuslimguy.com and an adjunct professor of religious studies at DePaul University. Lenny McAllister is a Republican commentator and radio host. Corey Date is contributing editor for The Root. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Thank you all so much.
God bless.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.